This program is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Network, a world leader in talk radio since 1998. Visit GCNlive.com today.
The problem with trying to understand history is that unavoidably, when you're looking at history, you're looking backward. You know how things turned out. You know, for instance, that this tiny little group called the Pilgrims somehow is important to us, tremendously important. We have a holiday in which we celebrate their survival. But if you're sitting there in the winter of 1620 and 1621, freezing to death, starving, watching your best friends, very often your wives, dropping dead around you, you don't know how things are going to turn out. What do you know? You know you're in what is rightly referred to as a howling wilderness. You have no idea whether some of the natives who must be out there somewhere are going to be hostile or friendly. You don't know how you're going to feed yourself, and you don't know emphatically if you are going to survive. After all, these pilgrims who came over to this new continent certainly knew about the lost colony of Roanoke some 30 years before, where an entire colony disappeared without a trace. They knew about a half dozen other attempts to start little settlements or fishing villages in what later became known as New England. These didn't last. They didn't survive. They certainly knew that the winter that they were enduring was far harsher than anything they had experienced in the old country. Who are these people? Well, by and large, they were ordinary, common, hardworking people, but with a real touch of deep piety and even scholarship. Look at William Bradford. William Bradford, who became governor of the colony and wrote the entire record of Plymouth Plantation, of this Plymouth colony, had a fascinating life. His father died when he was just a year old, and his mother married again. And his grandfather and uncles took him in hand and trained him as a farmer. At the age of 12, he became a constant reader of the Bible. And when he was just a teenager, he became so moved by the Word of God that he joined this group of rebel Puritans who met for prayer and discussion at the house of William Brewster in this very scenic and picturesque little village of Scrooby. And when that group, inspired by one of their leaders, organized itself into a separate church and got ready to leave England, Bradford joined it despite the, quote, wrath of his uncles and the scoff of his neighbors. Imagine that, a religious rebel, looked down upon by the people around him, largely through his own efforts. This fellow learned Dutch after they moved to Holland, and he also learned a great deal of Latin and Hebrew, and he acquired a wide knowledge of general literature. The most amazing thing is that he brought over with him on the Mayflower and then had sent to him subsequently a huge library of books. He lived for books and lived for writing in his own book the record of what he and the other pilgrims endured. One of the things that he endured is his wife Dorothy throwing herself, so it would seem, off the side of the Mayflower before they had even begun to build those sheds, those huts that would protect them from the winter. Perhaps she had been a Cassandra, seeing the future more clearly than others in that little band, because that winter was grim almost beyond belief and endurance. Six pilgrims died in December, then eight in January. On January 14th, they were huddled, sick, hungry. We're not even sure what exactly was the disease that killed so many of them, but it could have been any number of things. Certainly they were malnourished. Certainly a lot of the food they ate was probably rotten. Some of the kernels of corn they had found buried underground, flint corn, not particularly nourishing or good for them. But on January 14th, there was an icy wind, as only a Massachusetts wind can be icy, blowing through cracks in the nearly completed meeting house. Understand that these pilgrims would not build a church. They never, ever had a church. They had a meeting house. In their language, church referred to the group of people who comprised the church. The building was the meeting house. They were gathered in the meeting house. many of them lying on the ground, holding their stomachs, moaning, sick. And suddenly, before anybody knew what was going on, since they were warming themselves with a fire, the thatched roof above them had caught fire, and the interior was filled with smoke. Many people who were helpless with illness started to cry out in horror. The embers and some of the beams began to fall from the roof. Some of the sick people raised themselves with a strength that seemed more than human. Fortunately, most of the timbers did not catch fire, and the building was saved. By the way, they had some casks of gunpowder right there. They could have all been blown to kingdom come had they not put out the fire in time. But during this fire, much of their precious clothing was burned up, and they were further exposed to the harsh New England winter. And still the death toll mounted and added up. In February, they were dying at the rate of two a day, two deaths every day, people who needed to be buried. Digging in the frozen ground was itself a challenge to bury your friends and family. On some days, three died. The 21st of February, four people died. At one period, the entire company had only five men who were well enough to walk around and care for the sick. One of them was Captain Miles Standish. Standish was not a member of the separatist community. Remember, he was called a stranger. He is someone who had come along for adventure, but he ended up becoming part of the company and a stalwart of the company. He was a little man. His enemies called him Captain Shrimp later. Apparently, he was very, very short. He had red hair. He was also called Our Little Chimney because it was easy to get him sparking and flaming. He had a temper. But meanwhile, he was one of the few who didn't get desperately ill. He tended to Bradford, among the others, raising his head up and cradling it in his arm just to spoon him a little bit of soup. Meanwhile, in the harbor, the sailors stayed on the Mayflower. They didn't want to come ashore in the midst of the sickness. They stayed because Captain Christopher Jones, that good and generous man, had listened to the pleas of the pilgrims to stay around to help them. But people on board the Mayflower were dying as well. One of them, the boatswain, was stricken, described by Bradford as a proud young man who would often curse and scoff at the passengers. But when he grew weak, they had compassion on him and helped him. Then he confessed that he did not deserve it at their hands. He had abused them in word and deed. "Oh," said he, "you, I now see, show your love like Christians indeed to one another, but we let one another lie and die like dogs." In March, another 13 died, but at least that was less than the month before. Finally, when they were able to count the losses, of the 102 people who had crossed the ocean, 47 had died. The biggest toll, the most painful toll, was by March, 13 of 18 wives had died. What those wives had died doing was protecting their children, because the children fared best. All seven daughters lived, and 10 of the 13 sons lived. But the grown women, they were nearly all gone. And somehow, they kept their hopes up, and they kept alive, partially through coming up every Sunday to meet at the meeting house from the little huts they had built separately, listening to the preaching of William Brewster, who assured him that somehow this was all God's will. But finally, by the middle of March, things began to look a bit better, especially when the sun came out and they knew that spring would not be far behind. There was one particular day in the middle of March. It was a Friday. It was fair, the sky was blue, and they always looked back on that day as a key turning point, even though the day began badly. They were still weak, they were still fearful, when they saw a tall, muscular Indian wearing only a loincloth walking toward them. They shouted out, "Indian coming! Indian coming!" And they approached, carrying their firearms. But as he drew within range, this Indian shouted out in perfect English, "Welcome!" It was a deep, resonant voice. Then they replied, "Welcome." And then, in a fateful interchange, the next word from the Indian is, have you got any beer? And so the encounter continued and followed a shocking and surprising course.
Washington Policy Center, WPC, is Washington State's champion for free market reforms and is nationally renowned for its effectiveness in an ideologically hostile state. It's led the effort against state and local income taxes. Its research and policy analysis are relied on by lawmakers, media, and citizen activists for accuracy, fresh perspective, and to expose the political manipulation of data. Our state needs WPC more than ever, and we need you to be part of it. Become a member today at WashingtonPolicy.org. Is our country's distinctive power and prosperity the product of some happy accidents or criminal activity, or is it God's hand on America? That's the title, actually, of my most recent book. You can get a hardcover copy, personally signed by me, together with a full audiobook, and it comes to you together with an MP3 player so you can hear it anytime you want. It's all at a reduced price while supplies last. Go to michaelmedved.com, click on the banner for God's Hand on America, look for that audiobook and hardcover book bundle.
Introducing the all-new My Slippers from MyPillow. 2 years in development. Designed to wear indoor, outdoor, all day long. Made with MyPillow foam and impact gel to help prevent fatigue. And made with quality leather suede. For a limited time, you can get 50% off the new My Slippers. They're super comfortable, and you'll like them so much you'll want to get pairs of them for the entire family. Go to MyPillow.com and click on the radio listener's square and use promo code MEDVED. That's promo code MEDVED, M-E-D-V-E-D. You'll also get deep discounts on all MyPillow products, like the Giza Dream bed sheets, the mattress topper, and towel sets. Call right now 1-800-320-6280. That's 1-800-320-6280 and use promo code MEDVED. Or go to the web at MyPillow.com. The all-new My Slippers from MyPillow.
You've seen crazy diets to lose weight. At GCN Team, our healthy body weight loss system simply neutrifies the body, bringing down cravings. It has been proven that nutritional deficiencies drive appetite for carbs, sugars, and fats. Lose weight the easy way. Find us at GCNteam.com or call 877-878-4203. Fighting cravings is a fool's game. Give the body what it needs to be satisfied. Again, 877-878-4203. That's 877-878-4203. We've entered a time where sky truly is the limit and opportunity awaits. The internet has become a platform of everyone's worldwide communications. Billionaires building businesses on platforms that didn't even exist a generation ago. But in the sea of noise, how can the voice of your business be heard? The secret is over 100 years old. Radio. 228% more effective than TV. That's 228% more effective than television. Brick and mortar and cyber businesses alike have found radio to be the most effective for building a brand and delivering customers. Learn the secrets of radio advertising by calling 877-996-4327 or email advertise@gcnlive.com. That's advertise@gcnlive.com.
Do you want to give you and your loved ones premium nutrition right now? Hi, I'm Jamel Bookaboo from TeamGaday.com and the GCN Longevity Health Team. Get your premium nutrition formulated by world-renowned naturopathic doctor, Dr. Joel Wallach at wholesale, or also become a distributor and earn income while supporting this broadcast. Go to TeamGaday.com via the shopping cart or contact form, and I'll get back to you with support personally. That's TeamGaday.com with Longevity. TeamGaday.com.
Special edition of the Michael Medved Show on the real story behind Thanksgiving.
And part of that real story that you can absolutely use to win any game of Trivial Pursuit is what were the first fateful words in English from Indians to pilgrims in 1621. And the first fateful words were welcome, in a deep, resonant voice in perfect English, welcome. Have you got any beer? Well, the pilgrims didn't have any beer. And what do you say? This Indian walks in from nowhere, and he looks pretty intent on his beer. What they say is, our beer is gone. Would you like some brandy? And the answer, to no one's surprise, was, you betcha. So they sit down and drink some brandy together. It turns out that this particular Indian is named Samoset. And Samoset was a sagamore of the Algonquins. He was from up near Maine. He had developed both his English language skills and his taste for beer in contact with a number of the English fishermen who had tried to set up some villages, had sailed up and down along the New England coast. He enjoyed spending time with them. He particularly enjoyed their liquid refreshment. And now he told the pilgrims some fascinating news. The reason that they had been able to establish their settlement in Plymouth, where they had, on land that appeared to have been once inhabited, land that was cleared, but with absolutely no human beings anywhere around, is because this was land that had once belonged to the Patuxet tribe. The Patuxet had all died about 6 months before the pilgrims arrived, in one of those bizarre coincidences, leaving behind this area with springs and cleared land and even some corn stored away. Not a single person seemed to have been left of this small tribe. The nearest tribe was under command of a big chief named Massasoit. And Massasoit, or Massasoit, was actually was not such a big tribe. It was some 600 people, but compared to the 50 or so pilgrims who were left, that looked pretty formidable. He was, a couple of days' journey away, if you took your time. And what Samoset said that was so particularly interesting is there was a Christian Indian, again, who spoke perfect English, who was living with Massasoit. And soon, as the spring wore on, that Indian, whose name was Squanto, Tisquantum was his actual Indian name. He's known to history as Squanto. He, when he met the pilgrims, changed everything. Everything. As William Bradford declared in his own recollections, this Indian, Squanto, was a special instrument sent of God for their good beyond their expectation. He directed them how to set their corn, where to take fish, and to procure other commodities, and was also their chief pilot to bring them to unknown places for their profit, and never left them till he died. Squanto's story really begins in 1605. Now, we don't know exactly when he was born, but we know that by 1605 he was a teenager. And he was out hunting with his fellow Native Americans, fellow Indians, when a miserable human being, a miserable excuse for a human being named Thomas Hunt, a one-time colleague of John Smith of Virginia, and a sea captain, this Thomas Hunt, spotted them. Now, he and his men came ashore, and they took Squanto captive along with four of his friends. Why would they want to capture these guys? They captured them and clapped them into irons and took them with other Indians they collected to make money by selling them as slaves. It's absolutely appalling that this was done, of course, but please understand that in the 1600s, slavery was very much an international institution. It was common everywhere in the world. And one of the reasons that it never really flourished as an institution of slavers kidnapping Indians from North America is because so few of those Indians survived that experience. They'd often simply die in the horrors of being transported and the horrors of passage to somewhere else. In any event, Squanto was taken prisoner. He was made into a slave and he was brought to England, where he worked as a slave, worked as a servant, and lived there in England for 9 years. And as slaves could at the time, he saved little bits of this and that. He worked on his own, and finally, he was able to buy his way, partially to talk his way, into freedom. Now, in England, right after he was able to talk his way into freedom, he met Captain John Smith. Right, that same Captain John Smith of Jamestown, the guy with Pocahontas famously, John Smith was getting together a new voyage in 1614 to go back to New England, which of course is where Squanto came from. So Squanto asked if he could get on that voyage and go back to his people. Captain Smith, for a price, of course, agreed. And so Squanto headed back home. He was reunited with his family. He was reunited with his villagers. And, of course, his heart sang. He was so delighted. He was so thrilled. But his happiness didn't last, because as soon as Captain Smith departed, again, another ship came along, a British ship, with a captain who began capturing slaves. And he particularly wanted Squanto. Why? Because Squanto would be a more valuable slave, precisely because he had learned perfect English. So this time, they clamped him in irons again. They put irons on his legs, they put irons on his arms, he was in chains, a horrible situation. And this time, he wasn't fortunate enough to be taken in slavery to England. He was taken to Spain, and that was much, much worse. It was a disaster, in fact, because the Spanish were known as the most cruel slave masters of that era, particularly when it came to the way they dealt with Indians and Indian slaves. He was taken to Malaga, which was a notorious slave station. His friends were sold to North Africa. They were sold, by the way, for £20 each, which is the equivalent of about $1,400 a head, a lot of money at the time. Now you understand why these people were doing it. So just before they were about to sell Squanto to go to North Africa, where he unquestionably would have worked out the rest of his short life, and life was short for slaves in that circumstance, some Catholic friars appeared on the scene. And these Catholic friars had mercy and they had compassion for people who were in a position like Squanto's in slavery, and they had a Christian attitude, a genuinely Christian attitude, toward the slaves. The friars were able to buy and rescue a few of the Indian slaves who were there for sale, including Squanto. So he went to live with the friars in a monastery, and they made him into a Christian. He accepted Christ and became a Christian believer. Now, he never was a particularly well-educated Christian, but he learned to speak perfect English and perfect Spanish. He learned to pray every day and became, at least on one level, quite devout. And with the help of these friars who had befriended him and were impressed by his fine mind and his remarkable character, he got enough money to pay for his voyage back to the New World. Second time going back to that village that he had left, the Pawtuxet village in what is today Massachusetts. He finally arrived just a few months before the pilgrims got there. He landed in Massachusetts, walked back to his village, and he found it absolutely deserted. He heard the news then that everyone, his brothers, his sisters, his family, his cousins, everyone in his tribe had all died. In deepest melancholy, Squanto went to live with Massasoit. He had been living with him for several months when Massasoit came in April of 1621 to meet the pilgrims, and Squanto came along.
You're listening to a special broadcast of The Michael Medved Show. To download this history program, go to medvedhistorystore.com.
Anytime, any place, anywhere, radio remains the most intimate of all forms of media. At home, at work, in the car, on smartphones. Over 90% of consumers still listen to radio every week. That makes choosing radio as a place to advertise your business one of the best decisions you can make. Email advertise@gcnlive.com and partner up with an experienced GCN representative. Advertise@gcnlive.com. Easy, affordable, effective.
What if you could cut your heating bills this winter with your existing wood-burning fireplace and not spend thousands doing it? You can with Great Wall of Fire fireplace grates. Our U.S.-patented, made-in-America Wall of Fire grates increase fireplace efficiency, eliminate fireplace smoke problems, and come with a 30-day money-back guarantee. See our grates in action and get free shipping from walloffire.com or call 800-274-7364. Fireplace heat without fireplace smoke. Walloffire.com.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
As you continue to celebrate your Thanksgiving, if you're heading out and about, prepare to pay more for gasoline than you have in 7 years. The national average for a gallon of regular gasoline, just over $3.39 a gallon. President Biden announced earlier this week he would be releasing 50 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Reserve. Scott Hayes with a Toledo oil refinery says a lot more can be done.
I don't think so. I think 50 million barrels is a symbolic gesture. The president has levers he can pull. He can set the biofuel mandate today. That's something he could do. People would feel at the pump immediately.
Those who get reinfected with COVID-19 won't likely end up in the hospital or die from the disease. That's according to a new study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. You're listening to USA Radio News.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. And there's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a free copy of my lecture that tells you exactly how to do it. In fact, after you've lived a long and healthy life, there should be only two documents in your medical chart, a birth certificate and a death certificate. I'm Dr. Wallach with a warning. If you have a 4-inch medical chart, if you take prescription drugs for high cholesterol, high blood pressure, arthritis, joint pains, and other health issues, the medical profession is failing you. They're using you for an ATM machine. My free lecture is going to reveal what pharmaceutical companies don't want you to know. There's been groundbreaking research and discoveries on how to effectively treat or eliminate over 900 different diseases naturally. It's all in my free lecture called Deadly Recipe. So call toll-free 1-855-79-YOUNG. Again, that's toll-free 1-855-79-YOUNG. 1-855-79-YOUNG.
Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Pau D'Arco Super Tea comes from the only tree in the world that fungus doesn't grow on. As a result, it naturally has antifungal, anti-infection, antiviral, antibacterial, anti-inflammation, and anti-parasite properties. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. A one-pound package of tea is $34.95 plus shipping. To order, please visit shopsupertea.com. That's shop, S-H-O-P, super, S-U-P-E-R, T-T-E-A, .com. So the complete website is shopsupertea.com. Or call us at 818-984-6100 Monday through Saturday, 9 to 5 California time. That's shopsupertea.com at 818-984-6100.
Second time going back to that village that he had left, the Pawtuxet Village in what is today Massachusetts. He finally arrived just a few months before the pilgrims got there. He landed in Massachusetts, walked back to his village. Squanto found it absolutely deserted. He heard the news then that everyone, his brothers, his sisters, his family, his cousins, everyone in his tribe had all died. In deepest melancholy, Squanto went to live with Massasoit. He had been living with him for several months when Massasoit came in April of 1621 to meet the pilgrims, and Squanto came along. Now, here's my question for you, and it's a profound question. Look at this poor guy. He'd been sold into slavery when he was a teenager. He got out. He managed to get out. Then he got back to the New World. He was captured again and sold into slavery, again taken across the ocean. He was beaten. He was abused. He was misused. No one would have more grounds for hating every single European, anybody with white, pale skin. What would be a logical response from Squanto towards these pilgrims that he meets? The logical response are, these are white men, the same kind of men who have abused me, who have harmed me, who have destroyed my life. I want to kill them. I want to poison their water. I want these people to die. These are the people who are responsible, like it or not, for infecting my own tribe with disease. These are the people who've decimated, cruelly imprisoned and enslaved other Indians up and down New England. I want them all to die. I want nothing to do with them. So what does Squanto do? When, after 2 days of treaties and agreements between Massasoit and the pilgrims, Massasoit goes back to his home some 50 miles to the southwest, Squanto says, I'm going to stay with the pilgrims, and I'm going to live with them. What? Can you imagine? He's not enraged? He's not embittered by his victimization? No, he's not, as a matter of fact. Because Squanto learned, and he demonstrates in his life, perhaps the most important lesson that any American in the 1620s or in the 21st century can learn about race, which is that the important thing is not what race you are, it's what character you have. It's not the color of your skin, it is, as Dr. King says, the content of your character. Squanto had seen, of course, that white men were very different from one another. There were white men who enslaved him, and there were white men like the good friars who rescued him, who showed kindness, who showed decency. He clearly could see into the hearts, into the minds, into the souls of the pilgrims. He saw that they were good men, like the friars, and he wanted to be with them. He wanted to live with them. He wanted to pray with them. He wanted to be a part of their community. Is there any more important lesson about the Thanksgiving story? I don't really think so. The lesson here is that you can be a Native American, not just seeing your tribe victimized, but yourself victimized, and yet you can understand this highest principle of America, that you judge people based on who they are and what they do and how they act, not the color of their skin, not the nature of their background. Squanto did that. He immediately began helping the Pilgrim Fathers, and helping them to such a remarkable degree that most historians will agree that it was his ministrations, his activity as much as anything, that kept the Pilgrims alive in those early months. He was there for the first spring, their first planting. He was able to help them, to show them, famously, how you used herring and how that was the kind of fish they apparently used. You planted the herring along with the corn. You put it in the ground to fertilize the corn as it grew. He showed them how to catch fish and how to catch eels. The eels, actually, were an important part of their diet. And with all of this, he helped them, as well as helping them communicate with Massasoit, the nearby chief, and to make sure that there would be no harsh relations. He was held to be, and was indeed, a blessing for them, living with the pilgrims and enabling them to survive from the moment he met them until the time he died just a few years later. But clearly, the pilgrim story, the Thanksgiving story, is very largely Squanto's story, too. Think about the losses on both sides. Half of the pilgrim band and the strangers who had come with them had died in the wintertime. All of Squanto's people had died. They clearly needed each other, and his value absolutely couldn't be exaggerated. No wonder so many of the Pilgrim Fathers remained convinced that there had been some divine providence involved here. Try to think about this for a moment. I mean, the chances of finding a fervently Christian Indian who would provide them with help. And with the harvest that they planted, and with the summer going forward, they actually were doing much better. Was it a flourishing colony? By no means. You're talking about a remarkably small number of people who were greatly enhanced and helped by this Squanto. But they were happy enough at the end of the spring and the summer of their planting to want to celebrate their survival and the fact that things were looking up. And so they called a day of Thanksgiving, and they invited Chief Massasoit. That seemed like a politic thing to do. They had enough to serve. They actually caught some wild fowl, apparently. They had some vegetables that they had grown. They had some corn. They did not have popcorn. That is a myth. It's not true. They didn't. But the problem is, when Massasoit arrived for this feast, which we don't know exactly the date, but it was sometime in October of 1621, the first Thanksgiving, when Massasoit arrived, it's sort of, guess who's coming to dinner in Plymouth in 1621? It's Massasoit, oh yeah, with 90 of his braves. Let me tell you, those guys came with an appetite. This wasn't tremendously good news for the four only women who had to provide for all these guys. We'll tell you how they did it right after this.
This is Michael Medved at michaelmedved.com for Town Hall. Despite possible disappointment in the outcome of the presidential race, Republicans can find reasons for encouragement in the election returns of November 3rd. GOP congressional candidates performed far better than expected, making significant gains in the House and holding their own in Senate contests. These victories have set up the strong likelihood that Mitch McConnell, himself handily reelected, will maintain the GOP's crucial Senate majority. This means that the more radical, alarming elements of the Democratic agenda can be blocked in the upper House. No court packing, no Green New Deal, no automatic statehood for D.C. or Puerto Rico, no confiscatory tax increases. The founders, who provided for a system of checks and balances to prevent too much concentrated power in the hands of a single faction, would be pleased to see that even if a Democrat ultimately wins the White House, the tradition of divided government will endure. I'm Michael Medved. The real heroes of that first Thanksgiving in a gorgeous autumn day, actually a gorgeous autumn 3 days of 1621. I can give you their names. The names of the real heroes, actually heroines, were Elizabeth Hopkins, Eleanor Billington, Mary Brewster, and Susanna Winslow. They were, at the time, the only four adult women who survived. And they oversaw the cooking and the preparations, with the help of some children, for 140 people, some 50 pilgrims, and some 90 Indian braves. Massasoit arrived a day early, a day before he was invited, and he brought along these 90 braves before these four women who had to cook for this crowd completely despaired. Massasoit showed that the braves came along with a bunch of dressed deer. Now, this added greatly to the bill of fare, which we know included cod, sea bass. Wouldn't that be interesting if we had a traditional sea bass for Thanksgiving? Wild fowl, including ducks, geese, turkeys, and swans, cornmeal, and probably some wheat, and then those five deer brought by the Indians. Cranberries, maybe. Cranberry sauce, They didn't have sugar to make the cranberry sauce that we enjoy today. Popcorn, that's just a story. This wasn't the kind of corn that lent itself for popping.
The pain was very bad, and since I've taken Relief Factor, I've been able to walk normally again, and I was having a hard time walking, and the pain was very bad. And since I've taken Relief Factor, I've been able to walk normally again, and the pain has gone away. I really am walking pain-free. So I just want to recommend this to anyone who has severe pain or any type of pain. It is really a miracle product.
Try Relief Factor. It has worked wonderfully for literally hundreds of thousands, and certainly for me. Go to michaelmedved.com, click on the banner for Relief Factor, and order your own quick start. Nothing to lose but your pain, the whole world to gain. michaelmedved.com, click on the banner for Relief Factor, or call 833-654-PAIN, Relief Factor. Don't you get tired of commercials screaming at you to buy gold right now with inflated promises on future values? In an unregulated industry, you need honest, real experts to give you solid advice to protect your wealth and give you top picks, too, on the best coins and bullion based on real-time data and historical trends. For example, as environmental policy becomes a hot topic, one precious metal that's been significantly undervalued for years is potentially set to surge. Nick Rovich, owner of AmFed Coin and Bullion, has long recommended this precious metal. Up to 600,000 ounces of this rare metal will be needed by 2030 to produce green hydrogen. Nick is doubling down on this pick, and you should, too. Call Nick to find out more. Now, I've been friends with Nick for several years, and he's my go-to guy when it comes to coins and bullion. I trust him. You can, too. Call Nick at 800-221-7694, AmericanFederal.com. 800-221-7694, AmericanFederal.com.
It may feel like age is just a number, but the fact is, even if you're healthy and active, your immune system weakens as you get older. And if you're 65 or older, you're at an increased risk for potentially serious illnesses like pneumococcal pneumonia. One way to help protect yourself is to get immunized against vaccine-preventable diseases like pneumococcal pneumonia. Dr. Jorge Gomez shares more on behalf of the American Lung Association.
Pneumococcal pneumonia is a potentially serious bacterial lung disease that can disrupt your life for weeks. Adults 65 or older are over 10 times more likely to be hospitalized with pneumococcal pneumonia than adults 18 to 49. You may also be at increased risk if you have certain chronic health conditions such as asthma, diabetes, or heart disease. If you're 65 or older, vaccination can help prevent pneumococcal pneumonia.
This flu season, visit lung.org/pneumococcal and talk to your doctor or pharmacist about pneumococcal vaccination.
Folks, looks like food shortages are here and gonna stick around. Supply chains are breaking down, and inflation is back with a vengeance. It's all part of the shortage economy. What used to be unthinkable is now in the headlines. Are you ready? Do you currently have a stockpile of emergency food at home? If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com today, and you'll find an emergency food kit that's right for you and your family. My Patriot Supply is the largest preparedness company in America, serving millions of families like yours. Pick up a 3-month food kit that stays fresh for up to 25 years in proper storage. The meals in the kit provide over 2,000 delicious calories a day. That's important when you need to survive. Order from MyPatriotSupply.com and your food will ship fast in unmarked boxes to protect your privacy. Don't wait for permission or more empty store shelves. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com now. MyPatriotSupply.com.
What do we know about the way that they enjoyed this particular 3-day feast? Well, we know that it was their custom to sit out of doors on cloth-covered tables, on benches and forms. A few of the more important men would have chairs. Probably Massasoit would have gotten a chair. They ate with knives and a few spoons, but no forks. Forks basically had not been invented yet. They were not used by Englishmen. What they used instead of forks was very large linen napkins, about 3 feet square. Now, this was very important, not only to wipe your mouth, but because hands were used to both serve and eat. You would often use the napkin to pick up some of the food in the napkin. The dishes and trenchers, those were small, square, round wooden plates, were used, and very often 2 people would share one of these. The food was taken from serving bowls or platters and perhaps cut on a trencher before it was eaten, or just eaten without being cut. What's the description that we have of this first Thanksgiving? The entire tradition of the first Thanksgiving is based on one account by Edward Winslow, an eyewitness, he was there, who wrote, "Our harvest being gotten in, our governor sent 4 men on fowling, that so we might, after a special manner, rejoice together after we had gathered the fruit of our labors. They 4 in one day killed as much fowl as, with a little help beside, served the company almost a week, at which time, amongst other recreations, we exercised our arms, many of the Indians coming amongst us, and among the rest their greatest king, Massasoit, with some 90 men, whom for 3 days we entertained and feasted, and they went out and killed 5 deer, which they brought to the plantation, and bestowed on our governor, and upon the captain and others. And although it be not always so plentiful as it was at this time with us, yet by the goodness of God, we are so far from want that we often wish you partakers of our plenty." So he wrote back to some of those who were back home in England. It was a feast of Thanksgiving, but more related to the traditional British country harvest home than to some of the solemn feasts that the Puritans, and including the Separatists, also engaged in. Remember, these were people who did not observe Christmas, did not observe Easter. They thought they were pagan holidays. They did not observe saint days. They did their own feasts of Thanksgiving and their own special days of fasting and humiliation. Their service was very dramatic, the way that they worshiped God. There's a description from 1627 from a Dutch visitor. His name was Isaac de Rossier. And he says, "They assemble by the beat of drum, each with his musket or firelock in front of the captain's door. They have their cloaks on and place themselves in order, 3 abreast, and are led by a sergeant without beat of drum.
Behind comes the governor in a long robe. Beside him on the right hand comes the preacher with his cloak on, and on the left hand the captain with his sidearms and his cloak on, and with a small cane in his hand. And so they march in good order, and each sets his arms down near him. They made a point of bringing their arms, their guns, with them to divine service. This is on the Sabbath. By the way, they spent most of the Sabbath in divine service with remarkable dedication. One of the mistakes that people make about the pilgrims is they assume that they were Quakers, pacifists, wearing black, rejecting the ways of the world. Or otherwise, people sometimes think of them as Mennonites or Amish. They were none of these things. I mean, for one thing, they wore bright colors. They did not wear all dark clothes. They did not wear all conical hats with buckles on them. In fact, they didn't wear buckles at all. How do we know what they wore? Well, partially because, well, of wills that people left behind with their clothing in it specified. For instance, William Bradford, longtime governor, died in May of 1657. His will showed that he owned a house in Plymouth, valued at £45, an orchard and several parcels of land at Plymouth, a great beer bowl, very important for pilgrims, and two smaller ones, beer the preferred beverage, six leather chairs, three carved chairs, a great chair, and a court cupboard, 10.5 pairs of sheets, a large quantity of table linen, about 5 dozen pewter dishes, and, get this, a red turkey Grogram suit of clothes, a red waistcoat or vest, and one sad-colored suit, but then a stuffed suit with silver buttons, and an old violet-colored cloak, and two hats, a black one and a colored one. Not only did they enjoy wearing colors, but they were by no means pacifists. Miles Standish was the commander of the full-armed might of the Plymouth colony. 16 armed men. They used that armed might. They loved their guns. They, in fact, brought their guns with them to divine worship, did leave them outside, but associated guns with celebration, with the Sabbath. In other words, these people were not only the Christian rite of the time, and so they were perceived, they were also gun nuts, big time. Remember the description of the first Thanksgiving in 1621? What did they do with the Indians? They shot off their guns. And that was something of the way that you expressed enjoyment or celebration. And when they marched to the service on Sunday, yes, they stacked their guns outside once they reached the meeting house. And when they did so, the men and the boys who were 16 years and older marched off to one side of the meeting house, and the women and the remaining children sat on the other side. It was very important from a pilgrim point of view to show the difference in roles, to worship together at the same place, but from a separate position in the service. And that place of worship, that meeting house, of course, was not referred to as a church. It was a meeting house. The building was no more sacred than the candle by which the Bible was read. In fact, besides serving as a place of worship, that meeting house would also be used as a courtroom. And in Plymouth, it was used as the fort as well. No stained glass, no decoration of any kind. They were distrustful of that kind of ornamentation. And what kind of service would they engage in? Well, first of all, there were two services on Sunday. One was not enough. The first one was 9 to noon. Then that would be interrupted for a light repast. Then they would come back from 2 to 5 for intensive biblical study. And then at 5 o'clock would be Sunday dinner, which would be the richest, most hearty meal of the week, followed very often by a nap from all of that study, worship, and rejoicing. In the service itself, there would not be any hymns sung. They felt that hymns were not biblical. They had been composed later. Instead, there would be prayers that would be spoken from the heart, not by liturgy or formulation. The Lord's Prayer was considered a model to be followed, but it was not slavishly copied. Prayer was given by the pastor or teacher. At one point in the service, he would stand up, everyone else would arise, and the speaker would remove his hat, raise his eyes, lift up his arms, and speak. At the end, people would say amen. But there were also psalms that were sung, and the psalms that were sung would sound exactly like this.
Jehovah reigns, let earth exult with me. Let my land's many show forth joyful men.
How do we know exactly how the music in Plymouth Colony sounded so long ago? Well, we know because they carried with them a cherished book, the Ainsworth Psalter, a setting and translation of Psalms, which was their favorite form of music. People played it, they sang it, they cherished it. And that same Dutch visitor, Isaac de Rassier, who came in 1627, was deeply impressed with the piety of the Pilgrim Fathers. He had come from various Dutch settlements. Here's what he noted, in addition to them marching to church on the Sabbath day. He seemed to be particularly interested in the Indian women of the New World. He described the Indian women as fine-looking, of middle stature, well-proportioned, and with finely cut features. Usually, a gift of salmon, he said, was sufficient to make them lascivious. That was something he had apparently experimented with. He said they're very libidinous and very unfaithful. But when he came to Plymouth, de Rassier recounts his shock on learning that the pilgrims, of all things, have stringent laws and ordinances upon the subject of fornication and adultery. The laws do not in themselves surprise him so much, since the Dutch had similar laws, but the pilgrims, amazingly enough, enforce theirs very strictly. More surprising still was that the pilgrims interpreted these laws as applying to no messing around with Indian women. Faith was not a trivial matter for this colony. It was what the colony was all about. And when difficulties were encountered, the natural inclination was to solve those difficulties with prayer. Or, when there was one difficulty encountered regarding the economic structure of the colony, to solve those difficulties by restructuring that economy. In 1623, all of a sudden, the recognition came by Governor William Bradford that the collective socialist model that the colony had been set up on wasn't working. Everybody had a share of whatever was produced, but this didn't motivate people properly. So finally, Governor Bradford instituted the New World's very first privatization. Faced with a crisis, he wrote in his diary, the colonists began to think how they might raise as much corn as they could and obtain a better crop than they had done, that they might not still languish in misery. And so Bradford assigned to every family a parcel of land.
This is the Michael Medved Show.
Hey, travelers, do you want to save money on your next flight? Then pick up the phone and call. That's right, call, because the best prices are not online. They're with SmartFares. See, SmartFares has special deals with the airlines. When they have unsold seats, they use SmartFares to fill them. So you get airline tickets at ridiculously low prices. Our prices are too low to publish online. With the extra money you'll save, you can book another trip or treat yourself to dinner or shopping. So stop searching all of those travel sites to find the lowest price on your next flight. Let one of our SmartFares expert travel agents find ridiculously low prices for you. Call SmartFares today and get the best price on your next flight. Guaranteed. Also, save up to 50% off business and first class tickets.
901-424-5280. 901-424-5280. That's 901-424-5280.
I represent low-cost airlines, and we know a lot of you are not traveling right now, and we understand. However, if you do need to travel between now and the end of the year, now is a great time to lock in some of the lowest prices we've seen in a lifetime. Hey, in normal times, we can save you up to 75%, but now airlines are practically giving away seats. We have inside deals on over 500 airlines. Here are a few sample round-trip deals we found. Seattle to Vegas, $35. Chicago to Atlanta, $85. Los Angeles to Atlanta, $100. Of course, there are some limitations, but the airlines want your business right now. And cancellation and change fees are flexible. So fly somewhere this year, book now, save a ton, call right now.
802-341-4535. 802-341-4535. 802-341-4535. That's 802-341-4535.